session number 10601, reel 1.
Mr. Cottier, Reel 1. Perhaps we could begin by you telling me when you were born.
The 29th of the 4th, 1920.
And was this in the locality of Durham?
More or less, a place called Dipton.
How many were in your family?
At that particular time, five.
Were you...
I was the oldest member.
The oldest boy. And... what were your parents' employment?
My father was a miner.
And your mother looked after the
family? The family, yes.
Can you tell me something about your education?
Very poor. And then, in those days, there was no 11 plus. And if you reached the standard 7 class, well, you were good. Well, I only got to standard 5. So I was below par, as you might say.
Did you not get on with school particularly?
No, I never liked school because at that particular time I had an impediment in my speech and the teachers just couldn't be bothered, you know, to spend the time patience with me. And I think that's why my education was below par, because of the impediment in my speech.
When did you leave school?
1934. So 14.
You were 14. Was there any question of getting a job at that time? Was it going to be difficult to get a job?
No, it wasn't difficult to get a job because I was already booked for the mines. My father being a miner, lived in a colliery house, rent free. It was expected that I went to the mines. If I didn't, my father would be put out of his house.
Why was that?
Well, I think the reason was to get cheap labour. You see, when I went to the mines at 14, it saved employing an adult. And I was being employed at the rate of 2 shillings a shift. So therefore, it's economically better for the management to have someone at 2 shillings a shift than what it is maybe for 7 and 6 a shift, as it was there.
What did you feel about working in the mines?
Very bitter. Very bitter. Slavery.
Did you feel that before you actually went to work in the mines? Were you resentful about going there before
yes,
you started?
Yes, because I'd seen some results in mining. I'd seen men brought down the street after being injured in the mine on a cart with straw rather than an ambulance as you have today. Very frequently they would be brought down on a hand cart with a bale of straw. Little things like that, and poverty in general. My ambition was to go to the Considine Company, steel company, which then was the second biggest steel works in the world, and that was my ambition. But I couldn't fulfil that because my father lived in a colliery house, therefore I had to go in the mines.
Well, was the family itself in a was fairly poor, would you say?
Yes, very poor.
Well, what did the other members of the family do? Did any of them work?
You said no, well, they were still at school, you see, when I left school. They were still at school.
So it was important to have your income in?
That's true.
Can you remember what jobs you did when you started?
Yes, for the first fortnight I did service work, training with a pony and a tub, learn how to harness a pony, how to treat a pony, and first aid implements, how to handle them. And then after the first fortnight, you went down the pit and you were expected to carry out the task assigned to you.
What tasks were you given?
Well, at first I was at the shaft bottom, helping to pull the empty tubs out of the cage as the full ones were being pushed in.
Were you given a variety of jobs as time passed?
Oh, yes. I went on to pony driving, trapping, set riding, various jobs. But they all had their hazards, you know, they're uncompromising.
What sort of hazards are you talking about here?
Well, risk. Everything had a big element of risk. Safety in the mines then wasn't as it is today. And you could foresee the possibility of an accident before it happened. And I couldn't come to terms with working under that environment.
What were the conditions like in the mine that you were working?
Well, at the shaft bottom, it was bitterly cold, and you had to work continually all the time to keep in pace with the movement of the cage coming up and down. In other words, the speed of the cage coming up and down set the pace for you. You were being governed by that cage. You had to keep going. Now, when you got towards the cold face area, you had the low, the wet, the dismal, bad air, and just things generally uncomfortable. You know, there was nothing in your favour, even light. You wore a lamp on your helmet, carbine lamp, and it didn't give much of a glow, and you were restricted as to vision, which again added to safety. It wasn't life for a human being.
Was there any electricity in the mine? Was it lit?
Yes, there was electricity in the mine, but that was only to supply conveyors, like 5,000 horsepower motors and things like that. In the vicinity of the shaft bottom, you had electric lights in the vicinity of the shaft bottom, but within 50 yards, they didn't exist anymore, and you come into your own carbine lamp, you see.
Were you at all frightened by mine work when you started off?
Yes, I was frightened. You would hear roof falls in the distance, and shortly after, you would see someone carried out on a stretcher. You're always on edge.
Were any members of your family ever injured whilst you were working in the mine?
Yes, my father was severely injured on one occasion. Just before I left school, he was working with a pony down the pit called Oxo. And it was noted to be in a bit of a Barbary character, wild. And it had gotten him into a corner and kicked him in the skull. And as a result, he had have 36 stitches put into his head. Now, on that particular day, when that happened, I was playing football in the street with my colleagues. At the top end of the street, down came the handcart with a body on, and we all reached around to see who it was. Well, on this occasion, it was my father. And his workmen had brought him home. And they just laid him on the mat, as it was then. He didn't have carpets. Laid him on the mat with a rough bandage on his head. It sure happened at the time my mother was out and I had to go for the doctor. And of course the doctor arrived and had him sent to a Constant Infirmary. And this was just my baptism before I knew I was going to go into the mine, so it wasn't very encouraging.
Can you remember what you were earning as a new miner?
Yes, I earned 2 shillings a shift. And 1 week we worked 5 shifts a week, and the following week we worked 6. Of course, as time went on, you got an upgrading of 6 pence a shift at the age of 18. So by the time I was 18, I turned 6 pence a shift.
Did you actually keep any of that money? Did all that go to your mother?
Oh no, all of that went to me mother, father, family, had to give the family. But I got 2 and 6 a week, pocket money, which wasn't bad in those days. Bearing in mind I didn't smoke, which was a big help.
You said that you were unhappy in the mines, and by the age of 18, of course, you'd be in 1938. How did you come to leave the mining industry?
Well, we had a trade union official called Bill Shearer, and he knew that I wasn't happy in the mines. Of course, he knew the circumstances. But he informed me that I could get out of the mines if I joined the army and that there'd be no repercussions against my father. He was still maintaining his colliery house, providing I joined the army. And this I did.
Well, were there many of the lads that you worked with, were they considering the same route to get out of mining? Was there
yes.
a lot of talk about this?
Yes. They all had the same thing in mind, to get out of the army, to get out of the mines. But where could they go? That was the thing. The only place was the army. They couldn't go anywhere else.
Can you tell me how you came to leave the mine?
Well, I went to work at 12 o'clock on the Sunday night. And of course, I finished about 8 o'clock on the Monday morning. And walking home through the fields, because there was no buses in those days, walking home through the fields, I thought to myself, well, there must be a better life than this somewhere. So I thought I would have a go and join the army. So I got baths. Of course, them days was a tin bath. And I knew I had 9 pence left of me pocket money. And I knew the fare would be about 9 pence to Durham. That was the nearest recruitment office in Durham. So without telling anyone at all, I got bathed and dressed, and I got the bus to Durham. Went to the recruitment office, told them I wanted to join the army. And I thought to myself, well, suppose I don't get in the army, suppose I fail the medical. I've got no money to get us back home. I'd have to walk about 12 miles. Then have to go back to work again at night. But fortunate enough, I passed. I qualified. And the recruiting sergeant told me so. I got me 2 shillings a day pay. And I got 2 or 3 shillings, I forget now, allowance. And I got a rail ticket. And the King's shilling in them days. Got the King's shilling. And I was a rich man. I had about 5 shillings in one day for doing nothing. I was a rich man. So he told me that I'd be going to Fenham Barracks. I laughed. I said, look here, I says, I want to be away as far from home as possible. I says, Fenham Barracks in Newcastle, isn't it? He says, yes. But he says, you'll only be there for 6 months. Then you moved on to your parent regiment. Right. So off I went from the recruiting office to the station in Durham. When I looked over my shoulder, behold, here was a recruiting sergeant following me. He must have thought I was going to abscond with the money. Anyhow, the train pulled in. I got on the train. And I thought, well, when I get to Newcastle, I'll have a look around, because I'd only been twice in Newcastle before. I'll have a look around. I'll probably have a drink and make the best of it. I stepped off the train at Newcastle, and there was a Lance Corporal there by the name of Skelton, Lance Corporal Skelton, Audley Corporal. He must have received or gotten my description from Durham, because he spotted me at the central station. He just shouts, come here, you. Yes, your name Cotier? I says, yes. He says, come with me. So then the trolley buses was running from the central station to Fenham Barracks. And we got in the trolley bus, arrived at Fenham Barracks, and I was taken to a barrack room. Now, the barrack room was empty. Just beds, empty beds. Apparently, Ain Squad, which the squad I joined, had just completed 6 months training, and they had gone down to walking, and they were forming a new squad. And I was the first man in that squad.
Before you take us any further into Fenham Barracks, you mentioned that your trade union official, your friend, had talked about the fact that you could go to the army without endangering your parents' right to stay in the mine company's house. Had you ever raised that with them, ever discussed that with them?
No, because I was afraid I'd be talked out of it.
Had you talked with any friends in the area that you worked with that you were going to leave?
No, I was a bit of a loner. I was challenged to keep myself to myself, and I kept my thoughts to myself, and I used my own discretion, and when I made my mind up, I made it up. I didn't take anybody's advice.
When you got to Fenham Barracks and you were the first one in this empty room, what were your feelings?
I don't recall any feelings, except I felt a sense of security. I felt as if well, I'm here. Somebody's got to do something about this. I'm no longer on my own. Someone's going to take care of this. Someone's going to tell me what to do. Now I'm going to dump into a barrack room and leave me.
Well, what happened to you in there? Were you sort of given your kit and so on fairly quickly?
With about half an hour, the Lance Corporal Skelton returned and he took me downstairs, got a haircut, convict haircut, and then Dez had a lovely black wavy hair. But it didn't worry me. Then, of course, I was pushed into a shower. And then from the shower, I was taken along to the quartermaster stores. And, of course, the army beds in those days, you had what you call three biscuits. They're about a yard square, which comprised of a complete mattress. You're given these three biscuits at the QM stores. Then on top of that, you're given underclothing, shirts, khaki trousers, tunic, equipment, belts, pouches for the use of and all this, all piled up under these three biscuits. You don't know what you were getting or what they were for. You hadn't a clue. All you knew was your equipment. And, of course, having gotten all this, you then marched back across the barrack square, back to the barrack room, with the Lance Corporal following behind you, up the stairs, and dropping bits off as you go up the stairs. You had to stop and pick them up. The Lance Corporal wouldn't help you. Then when you got to the barrack room, the Lance Corporal would give you a rough idea as to how to lay your bed for that night. And that was it. That's the only tuition I got that particular day, how to lay my bed. Of course, I was told where the cookout was and what time the meals would be. And I spent most of my time just looking out of the window, watching the squads marching up in ground, drilling, you know, bout turn, right turn. Again, I was enjoying it. I wasn't dismayed in any way whatsoever.
Did you know what sort of career within the army you were heading towards? I mean, obviously you're a private, but
I had no ambitions. I mean, I had no ambitions. I was just content to be a soldier, you know, a private, like them, on the square. I didn't go out going in with any big ideas.
Okay, so you're in the barracks with your new kit, and were any other men joining you at this point?
Not the first day, but about 2 days after, much to my surprise, the first chap to join me was none other than my own colleague, my own mate, a chap called Bobby Charlton. He arrived in, and I said to him, "What are you doing here?" Well, he said, "I guessed where he'd gone to." He said, "I joined up and asked where you'd gone." He said, "They told me you'd joined the infantry of the line, as it was known then." And he said, "They sent me here." And that's a remarkable coincidence to see your own mate come in. I mean, 2 days after. To me, this was very stimulating. At the time, I wasn't alone anymore. I had a colleague. And of course, as days went on, others joined and joined. And I think we got about 30 in. The squad was formed, you see. Then we really got down to hard training.
In those early days when there were very few people there, how did you occupy yourself? Were you given anything specific to do?
No, I was just looking out the window watching. You weren't allowed to look out the window in those days. Not, you weren't supposed to be seen looking out of the window. But I did. And the only thing I ever did in those couple of days was go to the dentist to have my teeth checked. And he did a couple of drillings on my teeth. And that was all that I got. And it was penned in the formation of the squad.
But you were expected to stay within your actual barrack room.
I wasn't permitted. At least I didn't feel inclined. I didn't think I was permitted to wander about. I mean, you're in a strange land, a strange country, and, you know, you sort of think, well, this is where I've stopped, and this is where I stayed, and I'm told to go otherwise, because I realised I was under orders and instructions. I just couldn't wander around. I knew that.
Okay, when the squad had come to full strength, can you tell me something about the training that you went through at that point?
Well, it was early morning rise, of course, with the Revalley, probably 6 o'clock. And you had to get up, and each man was assigned to a job before breakfast. It's either to polish the coal scuttle, clean the windows, or do the toilets. And it was my job to do the toilets. This was done before breakfast. And of course, after you did that, cookhouse sounded, and you went to the cookhouse, somewhere in the region about 8 o'clock. Then about 8:30, you were on parade on the barrack square. Then it was mostly drill, foot drill. You know, getting to know your left foot from your right, and your right arm from your left. You know, sort of things people don't normally do. You marched up and down, left turn, right turn, how to stand, deportment, and all this sort of thing.
Were there any aspects of the drill which were specific to the Durhams at this point?
Yes, the marching. 170 to the minute, rather quick march, which took a lot of getting used to. I mean, normally you were used to march at a normal pace as you do in Civvy Street, and having to compete with this pace. And
did you find that difficult?
Not really, no, because the sergeant instructor covered the timing out too, you know, left, right, you know. He covered it out to you. It wasn't difficult. You were young and fit.
How long would drill take?
About an hour. And of course, it was after that they went to the PT, to the gymnasium. You got up an hour's PT, parallel bars, vaulting horse, wall bars, you know, general PT.
Did you have to go on runs or things like that at this point?
Occasionally, once a week, cross-country runs, ammunition boots, PT shorts, vest, and we should run up Fenham, around Nuns Moor, and back again. You know, it wasn't very long, it was very strenuous, and I didn't think it was. And of course, you went to school to learn about the regiment. You did about an hour's schooling, learn about the regiment, its battle honours, and the history of the regiment, the VCs. And more drill, probably this time, by this stage, but cane drill. Because in them days, a soldier used to walk out with a walking out cane. This was to prevent him from putting his hands in his pockets. And you had to learn how to carry the cane properly, how to salute with the cane. So you got what you call cane drill.
Do you carry the cane under your left arm, is that correct?
Only when you stand to attention, when you're saluting.
Otherwise, where would you carry it?
You carry it in your right hand, parallel to the ground, at the point of balance. You know, you've got the cane in your right hand, at the point of balance, so that it's parallel to the ground, and you swing left and right arms accordingly. And the only time you put it under your left arm, for some particular reason, is to relieve your right arm, for the purpose of probably saluting, you know, or putting a coin in a machine, something like that.
You had to carry it with you everywhere you went?
Oh, yes. That was part of your dress.
Can you remember any other aspects of a typical day at this stage in your army career? What would you do in the afternoons once you'd had...
Well, we used to have a discussion in the afternoons, what you call a mess room discussion, with a catering officer. He would come along and spend half an hour with us, asking us if we had any desires or designs or ideas about altering the catering, I mean meals, things like that, you know. And I brought one particular case up, a stotty cake, which lots of people hadn't heard of, and everybody started to laugh. But it did materialise, we did start getting stotty cake.
What is stotty cake?
Well, it's like a round fudge thing, baked quickly in the oven. It's about an inch thick, about 12 inches in diameter. And you can still get them today in various places in town, study cake. And when I brought this question up, that I like study cake, and then I had to try and describe it to the cook sergeant, what it was like, and eventually we did get study cake once a week. Corned beef sandwiches, study cake.
What about the evenings?
Well, the evenings was very much left to you. Now, this was very difficult because come 4 o'clock, that was more or less the end of the parades. 4:30 was tea. half past 4 or 5 o'clock was tea. But what used to happen, the squad sergeant, previous to dismissing you, at 4:30, would give you what you call a shiny parade. Now this entailed you having to place on your bed various items of your equipment, highly polished, by 7 o'clock at night for his inspection. Well, this would be maybe 2 pairs of boots, highly polished. Your bayonet scabbard, highly polished. Your equipment blancoed, Brussels was polished. All your buttons polished. Now then, by the time you got this done, you were just too weary and tired to go out. The sergeant would come along at 7 o'clock and inspect you, your shiny parade. In most cases, you were satisfied. But the problem was, having done that, you then had to change into your khaki, which then was knee crease and putties. You know, the old knee crease and the putties. You had to change that before you went out. And you had to be immaculate. Now, having had the shiny parade at 7 o'clock at night, it took you to 7:30 to get ready. You went out and you had to stand before the regimental police at the gate to see if you're fit and proper to go out. And behold, they would find a fault somewhere.
Can you recall that happening to you?
Yes. And the main thing was your chin strap on your peak cap would be on the wrong way. Left to right, to right to left. That was a thing. Or maybe your bootlaces was crossed and they shouldn't have been crossed. They should be parallel. Little things like that, and they'll send you back. So you sent yourself over to hell. And you never went out. But in any case, I never was a one for going out. I always had plenty of reading to do, regimental history and things like that, because I was keen on passing my second class trivia education. And I used to get down to reading and writing and prepare myself for my second class trivia education. Some of the chaps would go across to the Nathy for a game of darts, pint of beer.
Did you used to use the Nathy regularly?
Not regularly, no, because I didn't drink in those days. I didn't smoke. And if you didn't drink and didn't smoke, well, the only thing in the Nathy was what we called char and wads. That was tea and rock buns. And I was sick of tea and rock buns. And I'd rather prefer to stop on me bed and just sit and read and polish, you know, prepare myself for the next day. And it paid off in the end.
What did you make of the accommodation that you had at the barracks?
Good. Good. Spacious. Each man had about 6 foot of floor space, which is quite ample. And the heating was good because I joined September. You know, the winter following on, you had good fires and plenty of coal, and it's quite warm. I had no complaints with anything, and not in the way of accommodation or food.
How many beds were in there? Cots were in the barracks?
About 30 beds in each barrack room. 2 fireplaces.
And this would be the thing that had to be cleaned up first thing in the morning, presumably, all this?
Yes. Rivali, you had to get out of bed on the first note.